Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting today from the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas. Dallas, of course, of cowboy cattleman fame. It's got its own TV series. They're the football cowboys, of course. But this month, this city is looking back at its unique place in American history. President Kennedy killed here by an assassin 50 years ago. We'll talk with the organizers behind Dallas Love, a large-scale art project that looks forward and projects a community's recovery and some other initiatives here in Dallas. And later, a former Warren Commission staffer, the Warren Commission, of course, the official investigation into the Kennedy assassination. He defends the work of an institution that for some is synonymous with cover-up and conspiracy. But first, to a pair of Washingtons, D.C. and the state, where we've got some good news and some bad news. Actually, some good news may be motivated by a lot of bad news recently regarding the Affordable Care Act. The president trying to get out ahead of an angry bipartisan Congress. But we'll also take a look at why the state of Washington, 6 weeks into the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, may have some of the best enrollment numbers to show for it and why. But first, if you have lost your insurance plan since the rollout of the ACA, President Obama has a message for you going before the nation today, telling people you can keep your plans even if you've had notification that since the ACA rollout, it has been canceled. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us from Capitol Hill. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So two issues here, it seems. One, the president trying to preempt Congress on this cancellation question because there are initiatives afoot. And two, Obamacare will now apparently contain, at least for some time, what have been called so-called substandard plans that the administration has already said repeatedly are a financial drain on the whole system. What gives?
Yeah, both of those things are true. You know, ever since the trope now, the broken promise, if you like your health plan, you can keep it, period, started gaining traction in the political world, Congress has started getting nervous. Well, Democrats have started getting nervous, and Republicans have seen an opening on the attack. And it's not just Republicans, John, in Congress, as you mentioned. Part of the problem for the White House now, hey, if it were just Republicans taking another swipe at the Affordable Care Act, ho-hum, they've done it 40 times. It's worse than that. There are Democrats all over Congress, Democratic senators running for re-election in red states who are putting legislation close to the floor. And so some reaction today from the White House, as you said, to try to preempt. And it's a little bit of a nuance on what you said. The whole thing is, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Here's what senior administration officials tell reporters today. The White House effort says this. Individual insurance plans that were offering those plans in 2013, if you got a cancellation notice from one of them, insurance plans are free to keep offering that plan to you in 2014. They cannot offer it to anybody new. They can't keep selling it to new customers. But it also means that they don't have to keep offering it. What does that mean to the insurance companies in the political world? Sure, it means if you like your plan, you can keep it, asterisk, if your insurance company keeps offering it. If they don't keep offering it and you lose your plan despite the president's promise, guess whose fault it is now? It's now the insurance company's fault.
But that probably means that Congress will still go ahead with its various keep the president's promise bills to try to maybe lock in this notion of you can have your plan no matter what.
Well, they may, and you may still see votes on that. However, at this point, because the White House has said this, it makes it a lot less likely that the two disparate approaches between House Republicans and nervous, more conservative Senate Democrats would ever reach a reconciliation and become law. And certainly the White House wouldn't have to sign. The president wouldn't have to sign such a bill because he could say, I have my administrative effort. We're not going to enforce the brand new standards on these plans for people who like their health plan and lost them. And the White House effort, we should say, does a couple of other things that the White House is going to like here. One of the complaints from Democrats over this whole mess of people getting the cancellation notices when they didn't know they were coming is that insurance companies were sometimes using the cancellation to steer people back to other products that they already sell, not informing people of all the other options they might have on the exchanges in Obamacare with subsidies, even Medicaid. So the other thing that the White House is requiring under this effort with insurance companies is to say, yes, insurance companies, you may keep offering the 2013 plans to existing customers in 2014. But when you get back in touch with them, to people that you've canceled, you must notify them what protections aren't in the plan that they're keeping. All those goodies in Obamacare, like pre-existing conditions and paying for preventive services, community rating, and all the other stuff that consumers in the polls say they love to the tune of 70%. You have to tell them what they're not getting if they stay with your plan. You also have to tell them that there are new options, better coverage, potential subsidies and tax credits, even potential Medicaid eligibility if you qualify, available through Obamacare. So they actually have to sort of draw these things in bright red letters metaphorically, and they can't kind of hide the ball on the better deal that for many people may be available, if not in premiums, at least in quality of coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The White House wants to use insurance companies now as an advertising billboard.
Right, except how they're going to enforce that, that's kind of unclear here. And, you know, some insurance companies may go along. If not, we'll see what the penalties are. But I'm wondering politically here, Todd, if there's a sense among Democrats or anyone on the Hill that the president could end this with one statement instead of these every couple of days kind of incremental announcements, either expression of regret, some sense of we're trying to get things in order here. Do people think the president is keeping this going?
I think that they do, and there's a great deal of frustration, but there doesn't seem to be a way out of it. The website, hopefully, that hasn't been working. The White House says November 30th is our deadline so that it works for the vast majority of people. This broken promise that has caused political headaches, what else can you do but try to fix it by saying people can keep their plans? That's the political peril in this, and it explains exactly why red state Democrats from Louisiana, like Mary Landrieu, Arkansas, North Carolina, run down the list, and even a couple of blue state Democrats who are just fed up with the situation are now sponsoring and co-sponsoring legislation to put into the law to keep these health plans around, taking a swipe at the White House. And in terms of the red state Democrats, John, giving themselves an opportunity to vote against the White House on a botched rollout. Mary Landrieu says, hey, I support the Affordable Care Act. I voted for it. I'd vote for it again. I can't hide from that. But I'm sure as heck going to file this legislation and show my red state voters in Louisiana that I'm taking a stand against what's been going on.
Poll numbers say in those red states, this is an issue now.
It sure does for somebody like Kay Hagan. She's a Democrat from the red state of North Carolina running for re-election, John. She was doing pretty well up on a potential opponent up until about 6 weeks ago when the Affordable Care Act rolled out and all of the botched initiation things started happening. Her approval ratings tanked. She's now trailing in that race. She has plenty of time. We're not talking about whether she's going to win or lose, but she is a case study in nervous red state Democrats trying to get on top of this thing.
Nervous red state Democrats. That's the theme of today regarding the ACA. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet.
The other big issue in the Affordable Care Act rollout is the question of actual enrollment. Who has made it through the reported gauntlet of tech issues and foul-ups to actually get insured?
As of this first period, 106,000 Americans have enrolled in qualified health plans through the marketplace, and 396,000 people have learned they may be eligible for Medicaid or CHIP.
That's Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius in a media teleconference call on Wednesday. But those are bad numbers. If this program is going to succeed in achieving the goals of affordable care for uninsured Americans, they're going to have to get bigger. Certainly the well-publicized tech problems for the federal government's website have contributed to this. States are having problems of their own. In Oregon, the website is being retooled. They're back to largely paper applications. Hawaii's site wasn't even up until mid-October. Similar stories in Maryland, Vermont, and Colorado. But there are some better numbers to be found in Washington State. We spoke with Michael Marchand, Director of Communications for the Washington Health Benefit Exchange. There, a forward-thinking design approach and a possibly tech-savvy consumer base has put enrollment, just in that state alone, north of 70,000.
Actually, our enrollment is up now to over 77,000, and we have over 9,200 enrollees in qualified health plans. So we're continuing to tick upward.
All right. Well, part of the frustration for people is not really understanding who's counting what, but it does seem like you're having some success in Washington State. What do you attribute it to? The savvy of consumers in Washington State who are used to websites actually working, or is it something that the state has done?
No, I think the big difference between what we've done and what some other places have done, including the federal government, is we wanted to build a consumer experience that really mimicked what people see when they do e-commerce shopping online. And so the big differential between us and the feds is the ability to anonymous browse. That means with a little information, including where you live, your income, your age, and really just moving forward with that, you're able to get online and see plans that might better fit your needs and budget than what you currently have, or if you have no insurance, before you actually have to start providing a lot of personal information to go shopping.
And that is in contrast to the federal website, where you have to pretty much give them all the information to even begin the comparisons, and that's when you get the error messages and the unresolved kinds of discrepancies, so you get stuck very early on. In Washington State, you can really float around and lurk and make some decisions and then decide.
Right. It's imagine this, John. If you wanted to go into Barnes & Noble and look for a book, and they met you at the door and said, oh, you want to browse in here? That's great. Can I just have your name, address, phone number, email? And they asked you that all up front. You'd probably turn around and not go into the store. What we want people to do is go into the store, shop around, as you said, get familiar with products, begin to understand them, print stuff out if they need printed out, take it home, think about it. So when they go through the application process, it's much quicker because they're prepared to finish and complete it and enroll.
And your team is using a private sector model here in assembling this customer experience. What's it like interacting with the federal government?
We've had our fits and starts. Obviously, when the federal government gets a cold, we kind of get the flu. For instance, when the federal hub goes down for maintenance, we have to go down because we can't check eligibility. So we've had our moments. But that being said, I mean, when you think of the heavy lift they're trying to do for 36 states, not alone meet a database requirement for everyone else out there, it's been a pretty remarkable lift given the short flight path they've had.
All right. And that's, you know, that's the kind of spin we've been hearing. And I'm not prepared to argue it with you here. But in general, would you describe the experience in Washington State as an unqualified success or not a fiasco compared with some other places?
I think it's kind of like Kipling. You know, you got to see victory and defeat and treat both imposters the same. I think we're way early in this to, you know, say mission accomplished. I think we've got a good start. We're not without our own issues here. But, you know, I think we've done better than some other places. If you're just looking at numbers and performance, yes, I would say we've done better, you know, at times than the federal government right now. But, I mean, there's success will be defined not in the first 6 days or weeks. It'll likely be defined in the first 6 months, years, and outgoing time where we actually see the system work.
Well, we'll be checking with you on all of that. Michael Marchand is Director of Communications for the Washington State Health Benefit Exchange. Thanks so much, Michael.
Great. Thank you, John.
So from the city of Dallas, Texas, in many ways you can be a part of our conversations. We're soliciting memories from you of the day of the Kennedy assassination and its aftermath, the funeral of JFK. We've been getting lots of great stories from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Also, give us your impressions of whether the president reassured Americans on his discussion about the Affordable Care Act. And you can go to thetakeaway.org and get all the information you need on how to contribute to the relief effort for the people of the Philippines.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Greetings from Dallas today. We're broadcasting from the studios of KERA in Dallas, a community experiencing painful memories of 50 years ago.
I'll never forget my ex-husband's mother, who... they were in Detroit the first time I met her. She said, oh, you're from Dallas. That's where all the crazy people are. And I realized that a lot of people around the world and around the country had this image of Dallas as just being a rabidly crazy place where, you know, people would dare to shoot down the president.
It's the voice of Lisa Hembree, former Dallas County Treasurer, speaking in a new documentary, City of Hate, Dallas and the Assassination. How has Dallas moved away from that palpable image in 50 years? Quinn Matthews is the director of that documentary. He's with me here in the studio. Quinn, welcome.
My pleasure.
Also with us is Karen Blessin, who's artistic director and founder of 29 Pieces, a nonprofit organization in Dallas that's behind the Dallas Love Project, 30,000 pieces of art around the city, a massive community art gallery with a message of love, not hate. Karen, welcome to you.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Just personally, to both of you, what do you think 50 years later? What's going on in this community? Is it hand-holding? Is it a kind of, oh, I can't believe it's been 50 years, go away already? Quinn, what do you think?
Well, I think if you're under 60, you're probably not thinking about it that much. I mean, a very small percentage of the population of Dallas that lived here in 1963 is here now. It really is a different city, which is true of, I'm sure, all cities. Yeah, I think it's a time where younger people, and I'm talking about age 50 and under, are really learning about that time.
And Karen, for you, is it a mission of projecting this different city? What's going on for you 50 years later?
Well, I think this time is a time of really healthy reflection on what happened 50 years ago. It's also a time to honor the man, to honor John Kennedy, and to look back at his legacy and really the story behind him. I mean, what an incredible story he had.
And let's remind people that this image of Dallas as a city of hate is not something concocted by the media. It was really something that existed over time. Here's something from 25 years ago when the nation was marking the quarter century anniversary of the JFK assassination. Front cover of a local Texas magazine, still asking the question, did Dallas kill Kennedy? Here's journalist Jim Schutz.
I remember walking on the beach in Western Ireland in, I guess, about 1980, and running into this old Irish guy in cork boots. He and I started talking, and he said, "You're not a German, are you?" And I said, "No, I'm an American." And he asked me where I lived, and I said, "Dallas." And he backed away from me and said, "Oh, the city that killed Jack Kennedy."
Quinn, how surprised were you to hear stories like that in preparation for this documentary?
Well, not surprised at all, because I grew up in Dallas, and probably until about 20 years ago, I would hear that from people. Something about, I was somewhere in Europe, I'm not sure where it was, and a man learned I was from Dallas, and he held up his finger, pointing his finger as if to represent a gun, and said, "Oh, Dallas, pish, pish." But it's eroded over time. So that is not a surprise. I want to say that I did not start out with the title City of Hate. It was sort of inevitable after talking to people. I don't think Dallas was a city of hate, but I think it was I wanted to look into why people thought it was a city of hate. And there were real reasons for that.
And there are real reasons why you chose love as really the message for your project. Karen, how does art really step in here and change the story?
Well, art has an intrinsic power, and I don't know that Dallas was any more of a city of hate than many cities in the American South.
Of course not.
However, I don't think love was noisy enough ever then or now, and so the Dallas Love Project gives over 20,000 people the opportunity to use their creative talents to have a voice and to take it to the streets.
And how much noise are you making? Describe some of the events, things people can see, and how they've responded.
Well, we have art at more than 63 locations all over the city, including along the motorcade route. We're having a tsunami of international press. We're having the mayor start to talk about Dallas as a city of love. So in many of the ways of the criteria that we've set up for the success of this program, which is to change a little bit of the narrative, just a little bit of the narrative about how we talk about Dallas, I think we're succeeding.
And we've talked with people in our preparation for this, visit to Dallas and in our own coverage, which will continue into next week. If you were alive at the time, there are hugely powerful emotions. If you weren't alive at the time, there's a kind of mystery about the whole Kennedy assassination. Karen, would you say that's true?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was alive at the time. There was a mystery. There is a mystery. We go down the rabbit hole. We will never know.
How about you?
Well, I don't know. Ask me that again, because I want to focus on this.
Well, the issue really being, we wonder where we are as a nation, and there's a real dividing line. If you were alive when President Kennedy was shot, you have one experience. If you weren't, you have another experience.
And I was talking to a producer whom I was trying to interest in this documentary, and she sounded like she was maybe around 30 years old, and she said, well, I've talked around the office, and I really don't know anyone who associates Dallas with the assassination. That would have been absurd 25 years ago.
See, I'm kind of in that camp. I mean, I really do feel that America has turned a page. Looking back at the Kennedy years, it does seem long ago, although 50 years do seem to have passed like an eye blink at the same time. It's one of those curious moments of history. Do you think the people of Dallas are ready for this week and month to be over, Karen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can only speak personally. I mean, personally, I'm finding it all fascinating. I'm enjoying reliving the memories of President Kennedy. I'm actually fascinated by the kind of reflection that's going on among, you know, writers who are coming here, thinkers who live here. So I think it's very healthy this time to reflect and examine it.
Karen Blessed is the artistic director and founder of 29 Pieces, a nonprofit organization behind the Dallas Love Project. She's executive director of the Dallas Love Project. And Quinn Matthews is the director of City of Hate, Dallas and the Assassination. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So from one of our younger listeners here in Dallas, I wouldn't be born for 30 years, but I do live in Dallas, so I am all too familiar with the events of that day. At times it feels like I was there. For those of you who are old enough to remember, what stands out on that day almost 50 years ago when President JFK was shot in Dallas?
My name is Joe Guyon from Rock Hill, South Carolina. I was a senior in a Catholic boys' high school in Brooklyn, New York. We received the information about the president. First one, he was shot. The second, that he died. 1,500 boys left school in total silence. We didn't know what to say.
If you'd like to tell us something, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So what would a bank with huge financial interests in the economic powerhouse of China want to have most of all, besides, say, an exclusive deal with the government to hold all Chinese savings accounts? Well, that's not likely. It's not even possible. But the next best thing might be having on retainer the daughter of China's former prime minister, Wen Jiabao. It's the exclusive story in our partner, The New York Times, which reports a secretive deal by J.P. Morgan Chase to promote that bank's status with China's ruling elite. The Times reports that J.P. Morgan paid a consulting firm run by the prime minister's daughter, Wen Ruchun, who used the fake name Lily Chang. Ben Protes is one of the reporters who's been part of this exclusive Times investigation. Ben, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what is the most outrageous piece here, the secretiveness or the fact that this relationship existed at all?
Well, I think it's very common for banks in China to try to accumulate influence through the hiring of government officials, children, the sons and daughters of the ruling elite, as we say in the story. I think what's unusual here is you actually see it go all the way up to who was then the prime minister. And then, as you mentioned, there's the use of the alias. Now, it's unclear who decided to do it that way, but she used this alias, and J.P. Morgan knew that the alias was not her real name, and yet went about doing business with her to the tune of $75,000 a month contract.
And J.P. Morgan apparently had no problem with demands for an alias. And again, we don't know the precise details here, but J.P. Morgan seemed to have much more to gain here than Wen Ruchun.
I think that the idea is that $75,000 a month, while lucrative and certainly very nice, isn't always the most important thing. It's not just the cash for a consultant like this. Sometimes it's just the ability to build the resume and perhaps lead to other business down the road. Certainly the ability for J.P. Morgan to secure this kind of person on your payroll is a huge coup and potentially opens doors for the bank and the leaders of China.
Any sense of what J.P. Morgan Chase got from this and their response to your reporting? And what about the coverage of Ms. Wen and the family?
So they're actually, what we've obtained is a document that is a letter from her consulting firm to the bank that declares that, in fact, her consulting firm secured an underwriting assignment for the bank at one of the state-owned enterprises in China. It was a railway company. And so it's quite clear in black and white, and you know, there's no objection from the bank in the story, at least, that this was an assignment that the prime minister's daughter helped secure for the bank. So that's one major thing. She also helped advise on, as we describe in the story, the macroeconomic policies in mainland China. So I think it's the idea is that you had on tap, on the payroll, somebody who was able to kind of just help you navigate this, you know, booming country and that potentially could open the door to big business.
Any downside for Wen Jiabao or Wen Ruchun in China, or is this totally accepted?
I think, you know, in China, it's totally accepted. It's business as usual. For the bank, the challenge now becomes that this, as we detail in the story, this is part of one element of a federal investigation into their hiring practices in China. Prosecutors here in New York, and then you have the SEC in Washington and Boston investigating these relationships, not just with the prime minister's daughter, but also with dozens and perhaps hundreds of former government officials and current government officials' sons and daughters. And this is a major investigation that presents an important threat to the bank.
Investigating the relationship between J.P. Morgan and the government of China. Ben Protes, one of the reporters, part of a New York Times investigation. Ben, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This crowd will love it. Just have a listen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Here's a huge sports story that does not involve the NFL and any locker room bullying. Today, Indian cricket legend Sachin Tendulkar played the first day of his 200th and final test match. It's a five-day match, which begins today in Mumbai, marks the end of Tendulkar's 24-year career. The Little Master, as he's sometimes called, led India to a Cricket World Cup victory in 2011, and I could blah, 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 blah about his stats for an hour, but let's just give you one. When Sachin Tendulkar walks up to the crease, as they say, a billion people on planet Earth stop what they're doing to watch his magic. Cricket reporter for the BBC. You can actually have a career at the BBC being a cricket reporter, not so much in the U.S. Rahul Tandon is in Mumbai. He's been following Sachin for his basically entire career. First of all, welcome to the program.
Yeah, maybe it's time you had a cricket reporter at the Takeaway.
I think we need one. You know, I would love that job. It would take the pressure off of hosting, I think. Describe just how much of a legend Tendulkar is, really.
They say that cricket's a religion here in India, and that makes Tendulkar a god, as you said, John. You know, when he walks out to bat, this whole country stops what they are doing. India is a complex nation of many faiths, you know, languages, cultures. Suddenly, when Tendulkar bats, that all disappears, and everybody becomes an Indian. You know, he's somebody even your president has talked cricket about. Basically, Obama had this great tweet that he said, I don't understand it, but I like to watch when Tendulkar's batting because I want to know who is this man who, when he bats, means that the economic production of my country, the US, goes down by 5% because all the Indians in the IT sector stop working as well. So you may not like cricket in America, but Tendulkar's affected your economy as well.
Some have compared him to Ichiro, the batter for the New York Yankees. He's also been compared to Wayne Gretzky in hockey, Muhammad Ali in boxing. Perhaps Michael Jordan is the best comparison for Tendulkar. Do you think cricket can survive his retirement, Rahul?
Yeah, I think cricket can. I think whether Indian society can is a very, very different question because he has given a sense of identity. People have grown up with him. You know, in the stands today, there were people in tears as he walked out to bat. And when he comes off, when he finally finishes playing, you know, the tears will continue. A lot of people are saying it'll leave a void in their life. Some people are saying they will stop watching cricket because of Tendulkar. The best quote I heard today was from a guy who's almost the same age as Tendulkar, who says when Tendulkar stops playing cricket, a bit of his childhood will die as well because he's grown up with him. So, yeah, cricket will survive, but, you know, society here will take a long time to get over Tendulkar. He is one of the all-time greats. He transcends the sport in the same way that Jordan does with basketball. That is what Tendulkar has done to cricket. He has got every single child, you know, boys and girls in India, in front of a mirror trying to be him. And I think that will be his lasting legacy rather than the statistics.
So a political career for him, a running a business, you know, taking over from Ban Ki-moon at the UN?
He doesn't need the money, so I'm not sure he'll be running a business. He did have a restaurant, but he didn't do very well here. He is involved in politics at the moment, but he is very passionate about sport. He'd like to see India doing better in the Olympics. He'd like it up there winning as many gold medals as you do in the States. He'd like to have sport down as part of the national curriculum. So he may move into that area. But to be honest, after being a celebrity, you know, the biggest superstar in India for 24, 25 years, where you've not been able to have a normal life, he's probably just going to go and have a holiday, listen to some music. He loves Dire Straits and drive all the very fast cars that he has. He can't do that in Mumbai. There's too much traffic here. Maybe he should come to your part of the world and do it there.
Listening to old Dire Straits music on a lazy weekend sounds great. Sachin Tendulkar, of course, retiring from cricket. Rahul Tandon is the BBC cricket reporter. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Sultans, we are the sultans of swing.
Economic story now. Trying to deal with the recession and an unemployment rate in America that, while improving, is still well above the prosperous years of the last decade. We're going to take a look at something employers are doing that could have an impact on some of the most vulnerable workers in this country, workers highly likely to experience prolonged unemployment, people with criminal records. It's a non-traditional approach, and it's gaining acceptance. But to get us ready for a discussion of this, think of the number of Americans with criminal records as a nation within a nation. 65 million people, the size of France. People who have served prison time, faced the consequences for their criminal actions, but who also face a much longer prospect of unemployment. To deal with this, some 10 states have passed Ban the Box legislation, which prevents employers from asking prospective employees about their criminal records. Target, the nation's second largest retailer, also announced earlier this year they would stop asking the questions. Kai Wright is the editorial director of Color Lines. He recently wrote an article for The Nation called Boxed In, How a Criminal Record Keeps You Unemployed for Life. Kai, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to talk to you. And if we can think of people with criminal records in the United States as a separate economy, a separate country almost, how diverse is this country in our imaginations?
Well, it'd be pretty monolithic. It is overwhelmingly black and Latino and male. It is poor as a consequence of having a criminal record. It is young, and it's struggling.
And in terms of efforts to try to deal with that struggling, the Ban the Box legislation, do you think this can begin to have an impact, or what other sort of dynamics need to be in place to keep a criminal record from being a lifetime sentence of unemployment?
Well, that's certainly one thing that some community groups are pushing in, and it's succeeding in some states. Another place you're seeing it is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which has ruled repeatedly that not asking whether or not you have a record, but if you use that information as the sole decider on whether or not someone can work for you, they've ruled that to be illegal. And so they've begun last year starting to do some litigation, high-profile litigation of companies to try to change their behavior.
Well, I sense that there are court challenges here that are going to increasingly target this economic problem in the United States, which, as you say, is prolonged. But I'm wondering if there's also a cultural shift that needs to take place, that people need to understand on some level that, you know, in the criminal justice system, if you've paid your debt to society, if you've served your time, that should be the end of it. We don't really think that way in America these days.
Well, we don't. And I think you have to look at two big things. One is, frankly, just the scale of the population we're talking about. And I think that impacts this cultural question is, you know, by 2000, 3% of the country had been locked up. That's an enormous number of people and unparalleled anywhere on the globe. And so the culture that allows that says we should be incarcerating that many people in the first instance will then struggle to understand that statistically those people are really not likely to commit crimes when they come out. We think so much about recidivism, but as one of the guys that I profiled, you know, by the time he committed a crime when he was 22, by the time he was 27, I think the number is, he was no more likely to commit a crime than anybody else.
Hmm. Well, let's talk then about arguments for employers to either embrace this ban the box approach or take a more responsible, I don't know, progressive approach to this here.
Well, yes, but also, I mean, you just have to follow the law. So, you know, the law says that you cannot deny someone employment solely because they have a criminal record, because doing so is a de facto violation of the Civil Rights Act because of the fact that there is such a racial disparity in the number of people who have criminal records. Now, that is the ruling going back to 1987 and repeatedly solidified by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission as recently as 2012.
You know, forget the law for a moment, and I'm not doing it out of any disinterest in the law, but do recessions exacerbate this problem in the sense that there's a last hired, first fired, or a, you know, sort of low rung yeah. on the economic ladder problem, that when there is unemployment, these are the people who are going to suffer the most?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, recessions exacerbated in a few ways. One, you know, employers are looking for quick and easy ways to thin through the job application pile. And sorting for criminal records is one of them. I think there's a really striking study that showed that there was a researcher back in 2003. So this was coming out of the 2001 recession. And she sent tests. She sent test applicants in New York City and Milwaukee who had exactly the same resumes, had been coached to look exactly the same way. One black and one white, in each of them with and without a criminal record. And what she found was that there is a ranking of who gets called back. The white applicant with no criminal record, 34%, I think, was the number. The white applicant with a criminal record, 17%. The black applicant with no criminal record, 14%. So less than the white applicant with a criminal wow. record. But the black applicant with a criminal record, 5%. So what you're seeing is just a sorting of the applicant pool, first by race and then by criminal records. And when you do that, you start to see explanations for why we are stuck at 13% unemployment amongst African Americans.
All right. Finally, then, what do you think the broad sociological impact of having a nation the size of France residing completely in the U.S., 65 million Americans with criminal records, so an overwhelmingly black nation. What is the sociological impact of that entity being entirely within the borders of the U.S., do you think, in terms of impact on cities, impact on law enforcement, impact on government spending?
Yeah. I mean, we know it. It's hugely expensive. It's and unproductive. What you end up doing is creating a shadow economy, but a whole group of shadow people. We're familiar with this conversation now when we talk about the undocumented population in the United States. I believe that it's, you know, it's fair to think of these men in very much that same way. You know, in many states, they cannot vote. Going beyond jobs, there's a huge range of things. You can't get a student loan, a federal student loan. There are over 800 occupations where you cannot get licenses. In New York City and in a number of places, you can't be in public housing if you had certain convictions. There's these enormous number of ways in which you're carved out of society, and jobs being the most stark of them.
Kai Wright, editor of Color Lines, contributor to The Nation, his piece on the impact of criminal records on African-American males and unemployment is in The Nation magazine. Kai, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Warren Commission is not something people in America are generally neutral about. Even if you were born long after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, you either think the 888-page Warren Commission report was the responsible attempt by the government to move the country past a national tragedy? Or you think it was a pack of lies, a fictional cover-up worthy of Hollywood, or at least director Oliver Stone?
Why was Kennedy killed?
There's a death warrant out for me, you know?
Who benefited?
The government's going to jump all over your head, Jimbo.
Who has the power to cover it up?
To this day, I have serious doubts that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
Really?
I mean, I'm not sure if anybody else was involved. I don't go down that road with respect to the grassy knoll theory and all of that. But I have serious questions about whether they got to the bottom of Lee Harvey Oswald's time and influence from Cuba and Russia.
The seeds of doubt from the beginning of the Warren Commission investigation, cultivated by Hollywood movies and pop culture, and expressed even today by Secretary of State John Kerry in a recent interview with NBC's Tom Brokaw. Howard Willens went to work on the Warren Commission a week after Kennedy's death. He was a senior staff attorney on the commission and author of the new book, History Will Prove Us Right, which defends the findings of the commission that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman and acted alone, and that Jack Ruby, who killed Oswald 2 days later, also acted alone.
There was a great debate, as you probably know, about how to deal with the assassination, because killing the president was not a federal crime back in 1963. So the responsibility for prosecuting the assassin or alleged assassin would have been with the state of Texas and the county of Dallas. So with the possibility of Texas proceedings and congressional investigations and so forth, President Johnson changed his mind and decided there should be a presidential commission.
There was an emotional component in the sense that you were reliving an experience that was so painful for America in some of the testimony. And then there was just purely the forensics trying to get to the bottom of this thing. Was Jackie Kennedy's testimony the most painful emotionally before the commission?
Well, I think it was, and it also has become one of the areas where there was disagreement at the time within the staff as to how her testimony was handled. And I did talk to the Attorney General, Bob Kennedy, about how he wanted to handle his sister-in-law's appearance before the commission. And he wanted it to be a very small group. He did not want to compel her to re-engage over a period of time in her recollections of what actually happened. So the criticism arises from the fact that her testimony was taken by the Chief Justice and J. Lee Rankin with the Attorney General in the room and a court reporter, and it lasted for only 9 or 10 minutes. Members of the staff who had prepared extensive questioning for her were quite offended by this turn of events, and my former classmate from law school and five-term Senator Ireland Spector described her testimony as worthless. I disagree with that, and it's an area where I think the Chief Justice made a humane and reasonable decision at that time, and I really do believe that any lawyer who looks at what she had to say would have thought long and hard before embarking on dozens of detailed questions to elicit more information from her.
How important was the Zapruder film in your investigation, and how much did it get in the way in some ways of reaching the truth?
Well, it was an incredible coincidence that everyone, including the federal investigative agencies and the commission, had access to that 26 seconds of film that must now be regarded as one of the most historic short films in the history of the United States. And it was the constant viewing of that which eventually led the commission staff to come up with this proposition that it may have been a single bullet that wounded both the president and the governor, which became the single bullet theory that has been challenged and in some instances ridiculed over the decades.
Oliver Stone, the filmmaker, did he ask you to consult on his movie of all
no,
this?
No, I did not receive that honor, but I did testify in 1992 before a congressional committee, shortly after Oliver Stone had testified and was greeted with the adulation and of the members of Congress who were eager to elicit from him further details about his conspiracies that featured the President of the United States, President Johnson, being part of a cover-up to conceal the real truth about the assassination. And I testified that, in my humble opinion, I thought he was a better screenmaker, a producer, than a historian. I think he was wrong then, and he continues to be wrong in every important respect now.
Why do you think Oswald did it?
Well, the absence of any clear motive is another complicating factor, and I think it has influenced people to look for a conspiracy. Because a conspiracy, whether it's the CIA or the Soviet Union or Cuban exiles, at least provides an explanation. What people don't realize who think there must have been a conspiracy here is that Oswald got his job at the Texas School Book Depository about a month before the assassination, totally by chance, and without any knowledge at that time that there would ever be a presidential motorcade. But the absence of a clear motive leaves people free to speculate on possible relationships that may have influenced him.
50 years later, do we live in a time where we actually expect things like this to happen, expect crazy, disgruntled, angry shooters to pop off at our presidents, at celebrities, at school children, for that matter?
Yes, I do think we do. And what it prompts two thoughts. First, no one really wants to accept the frequency and commonality of these horrific events to be part of our normal life. But I'm also interested in the sense that when we do have those incidents, people do take it as either senseless or personality disorder. They do not look for a conspiracy with the intensity and conviction that they apply when they look for Oswald's motives in killing the president. So we accept it to some extent. But when presidents are concerned, I think we are committed to a search more broadly for a definitive motive and a possible conspiracy.
I wonder if part of the mythology of this event is that in some metaphorical sense, this feeling of menace we have in America, is Oswald still up there?
I think he is, in part because of the mythology about that particular president and Camelot and all the aspirations that many of us had who lived through that decade, and then over that decade saw a series of assassinations, saw involvement in the Vietnam War, then turned to Watergate in the next decade. And I think that that series of events has led to a distrust of government officials and skepticism, apprehension, and we do live in that community today, and we have difficulty, I think, in adjusting to it.
Howard Willens, thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
Howard Willens is the author of History Will Prove Us Right and a member of the Warren Commission. What do you still remember about the death of President John F. Kennedy?
This is Judy in Boston. I was only 3 years old when JFK was shot, but because of my parents' stock reactions, I vividly remember watching something that they found disturbing on the news on our old black and white TV. Oddly, years later, this dynamic repeated when I was home with my then 3-year-old son and as I watched my TV in horror on 9/11. My son still has a clear memory of this, too.
We're collecting stories of your memories from that November day back in 1963. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story. We're also watching news from the Philippines. People in the typhoon-affected area still struggling to get clean water, shelter, and gasoline. If you want to help, go to thetakeaway.org, where we have a list of agencies providing aid for victims from Typhoon Haiyan. Your donations will help the relief effort. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.